A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man, and that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Shocking, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Soul. Joining me for another episode of the Weird Down Under is Holly Soul. That's what she said. Weird Down Under.
Sigh. This one's not so much Weird Down Under as one of those things the government doesn't talk about.
It's funny. They don't do that a lot with a lot of our military, do they?
Yeah, surprising. And like Everyone's so shocked and horrified about the modern military conflicts or what are they? Not conspiracies, not conflicts.
Cover-ups.
That's the one. Modern military cover-ups, but then they forget about the Liverpool riots, the Battle of Central Station, and now this.
Yep. There's a lot. It's quite interesting. We're going to talk a lot about this as we delve into the actual day of the Battle of Darwin. There are some problems that occur on the ground.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, like, you know, if it's right essentially to swing the judgmental pendulum towards the people in the past, in regards to the fact that Australians had never really, you know, we hadn't seen combat on our shores.
This happened about four and a half-ish months before the Japanese appeared in Sydney Harbour. So just keep that in mind in your timeline.
Yeah. For a very young country, this is our first real,
wartime exposure.
Yeah, yeah. Like people actually in the continent are experiencing it. Whereas, you know, World War One, it was a continent over there. You know, it was far away.
There was at least one sea between us and them.
That's right. There wasn't a direct threat. And then in this case, there is a direct threat and it's actually on our shores. You know, so can you blame the sort of dad's army antics that would follow? Do you know what I mean when I said
no,
dad's
you're gonna
army?
Have to explain that.
Dad's Army is about, it was a British sitcom about a bunch of army reservists who were like, they're old men and you know, the young men had gone off to fight the war while they were the army reserve and they were called Dad's Army. And people colloquially use that term, at least in Britain and Australia, to refer to something as being dodgy. You know, it's like, oh, that's a real Dad's Army of this or that's a real Dad's Army of that.
I mean, the closest experience I have to that is the term Bodgy Brothers Project.
I've never heard of that at all.
Yeah, it's something that's sus or done a bit dodgy is the Bodgy Brothers Project.
Right. Yeah. No, we always said the dad, oh, that's the dad's army of that. So, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you know, we're going to go through the events of the day itself. Absolutely horrific day for everyone who was there. And then, yeah, we'll just like we did with our submarine attacks in Sydney Harbour, we're going to bring to light some things that really went wrong on the day. So take it away, Holly.
On February 10, 1942, a Japanese reconnaissance aircraft overflew the town of Darwin and identified an aircraft carrier, which was actually the seaplane tender, the USS Langley, 5 destroyers and 21 merchant ships in Darwin Harbour, as well as 30 aircraft at the town's 2 airfields. Among the ships in harbour were those returned the morning before the attack from the convoy escorted by the USS Houston.
Houston.
I thought Houston was just a U. It wasn't OU.
Oh, I don't know, but I think that's Houston. I read that as Houston.
I'm going to bow to you on that one.
I mean, like,
I'm just going to say Houston. And if it's wrong, then I'm sure, like,
everyone will let us know.
I'm sure aircraft enthusiasts will let me know because Houston Mission Control.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I always think of Superman, the very first film with Christopher Reeves. Oh, no, sorry, the second film with Christopher Reeves. And Ursa says, you know, are you from planet Houston? So you get very confused in that film.
These ships were involved in the failed effort to reinforce Timor, which they had lost to the Japanese. The Australian Army's anti-aircraft defences of Australia was comprised of 16 QF 3.7-inch AA guns and 2 3-inch AA guns, used to counter aircraft flying at high altitude, as well as a small number of Lewis guns for use against low-flying raiders. So basically, when you look at an aircraft carrier, you have massive guns, you have little guns.
Yeah.
We've only got really little guns and then really, really little guns.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's very apparent that it wasn't really equipped to repel anything. I don't even know if the Australian government and the US government, because it was essentially a joint operation between the two allies. I don't know if they ever considered Darwin to be a real target.
I think they thought they were always going to deter the Japanese before they got anywhere near it.
Yeah, I think so too. I think they always assumed that, you know, they're not going to attack here. Like, it's too obscure. It's too out of the way. It's on the Australian mainland. It's Borneo relatively safe.
Borneo won't fall. Oh, shit, Borneo's fallen. All right, Timor won't fall. Fuck, that's fallen too. Yep. We've only got the tiny guns left in Darwin, so Australia is now fucked.
Yeah, I think there was the assumptions that they'd never get that far or that Darwin would never present itself to be in such a target.
Yeah.
However, as we discussed in the previous episode, it's really good little target if you want to cause a decent amount of damage and distract from a much larger attack.
Yeah. The crews of these guns had conducted little recent training due to ammunition shortages, which was a common issue around the world at the time, not specifically to Australia.
It was also a big problem because you want to train people in the use of guns.
Mm-hmm.
Those sort of guns especially, which are anti-aircraft, it's not like just jumping into them like a video game, strapping them on and just going for it. You have to feel the machinery. You have to know how it fires. You have to learn
the recoil rate. You have to learn how far it'll swing, what way the bullets will twist.
Or the little manufacturing errors. You know what I mean? Like like everything has its own little kinks and you've got to sort of tweak how you use it.
It's like if you get in your car and then you get in, say, your other half's car, there will be differences even if there's the same model.
Yeah, exactly, because no machine is made perfect and no person operating the machine is perfect. So you want as much practice as you can get in. That's why we get people to practice before we let them drive a car.
Exactly. The Air Forces stationed in and near the town of Darwin comprised of number 12 Squadron, which was equipped with a Wirraway Advanced Trainers, which were pressed into service as fighters. They're a type of plane. And number 13 Squadron, which operated Lockheed Hudson Light Bombers, which are the same kind that killed three federal cabinet ministers in Canberra in 1940. We covered that in a very recent episode.
Yes, we did. We did indeed. That was our Halloween. So go back and have a listen to that if you'd like the full story there.
Six Hudsons, three from number 2 Squadron and three from number 13 Squadron, also arrived in Darwin on the 19th of February after evacuating from Timor.
Yeah, it was Darwin was a great little outpost, really, wasn't it? Like, it was a sort of reconvening point. It was close to Japan, which means that, you know,
it was close to the Japanese front line.
Well, that's it. You know, they could stage a lot of stuff there and basically attack the Japanese, or at least prevent their constant migration. They were moving forward.
Oh, they would just kept pushing.
They just kept pushing. So obviously America didn't want Australia to fall to the Japanese, and then vicariously to the Nazis. So Darwin was this great little spot where it was sort of in this perfect position to get people to have some shore leave, to, repair equipment, to bring in your ships and just take a minute before moving back to the front. So it was a great little staging ground. And it was sort of like it was the third in a chain, as Holly explained earlier. It was the third in a chain with them being like, well, we've got the spare, so if the first one falls, that's okay.
And Borneo's gone. It's fine.
Yeah.
And then Java's gone. Oh, fuck. Well, Timor's gone. Well, we're screwed.
We've got the spare, so we'll be fine.
None of the six Wirraways at Darwin on the day of the raid were actually serviceable. At the time of the event, there was no functional radar to provide early warning of air raids, and the town's civil defences were very negligible.
And that's what makes me think that they didn't ever they never thought that Darwin would be a legitimate target.
No, it was never in the plan.
Yeah, it was never built to defend itself. Like, if you assume that it would be constantly bombed or attacked, you would build it to defend
itself.
You have
your artillery, you have everything.
Yep.
In addition to the Australian forces, 10 United States Army Air Services, Curtis P-40 Warhawks, were passing through Darwin en route to Java on February 19. The P-40 pilots had very little experience in combat. 65 various Allied warships and merchant vessels were in Darling Harbour at the time of the raids.
Sorry, we're in Darwin Harbour.
I said Darling, didn't I?
You did.
65 various Allied warships and merchant vessels were in Darwin Harbour at the time of the raids, including vessels from the US Navy, the Royal... I can't remember what it stands for, but it's the UK Navy, the Australian Navy, and other Allied forces. Several US Navy and Australian troop ships were in the harbour, along with a number of merchant vessels of varying sizes. Most of these ships in the harbour were anchored near each other, as the harbour itself was not large enough to accommodate so many ships, and there was very little consideration to the effect this could have under an air raid attack.
Now, you may be wondering as well, why would you have a bunch of merchant ships mingling with military vessels? Now, you number
supply
one,
them somehow.
Well, they're supply ships, so that's number one. But I learned a very interesting little story the other day.
Is this Dunkirk or is this a different story?
It's a different story. It comes to us via the Office Ladies podcast because they do a lot of trivia related to the episode. Now, there's an episode of The Office where Michael throws a bunch of mini Mounds bars at a captive audience, and they explain the history of the mini Mounds bars. During World War II, they were unable to source coconut through their usual supply line, so they created a merchant vessel fleet to get coconut. They were also running secret missions behind enemy lines so that the Nazis couldn't work out what they were doing. And also providing chocolate to the US Army during World War II.
Honestly, I am not surprised in the least.
Yeah. So I thought that was a fascinating little bit of trivia. But that's attributed to them. They uncovered that. So
I mentioned Dunkirk because there were a lot of merchant vessels used in the evacuation of Dunkirk Beach because that was the ships they could get hold of at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, that's a great film. That's one of my favorite Christopher Nolan films, especially when the merchant fleet just comes in to start rescuing the soldiers.
Yeah.
And there's just that one old sea captain and he's got a very small boat. Mm-hmm. And it's like, where are we going, sir? And he's like, we've been called into duty, son. And they get on with it.
He's like, I'm not letting any of the soldiers row my boat. I'm driving it.
He just takes off. Yeah. And they get in and they get the job done. You often have a lot of civilian and merchant equipment mucking around with military during times of war.
Early in the morning of February 19, 1942, four Japanese aircraft couriers. Now, I actually tried to practice these. So, Akagi.
Yes.
Kaga.
Yep.
Kiryu and Soryu launched 188 aircraft into the sky, heading south for Darwin.
I would actually say it's not Kiryu. I would say that's Hiryu.
I thought that's what I said.
So, I think...
Hiryu or something like that.
The only reason I am slightly confident...
Anime.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think you nailed it. Akagi, Kaga, Hiryu, and Soryu.
It's unfortunate that I know how to pronounce Japanese names better than I do Aboriginal names, but...
We're trying.
We're trying. These four aircraft carriers were also members of the bombing force that hit Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941.
For more on that, don't watch the terrible Michael Bay movie.
Watch Christopher Nolan, don't watch Michael Bay.
Yeah, Dunkirk better, Pearl Harbor bad. What was that Steven Spielberg World War II movie? Not Schindler's List, because that's a very good film. The other one it's sort of like in the middle between Dunkirk and between Pearl Harbor.
I don't know, what was I haven't it called? Seen it.
Had Vin Diesel in it, he gets shot in the head.
No,
Tom
idea.
Hanks, Saving Private Ryan. Haha.
I thought that was Vietnam War.
No, Saving Private Ryan is World War II.
Well, I've
War
never
II.
Seen it, so I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. The intro is very graphic storming of Normandy.
I like might the landing be on Normandy confusing Beach. It with Black Hawk Down. There are so many war movies.
That's Afghanistan.
Well, definitely fucking,
There's
I'm
a lot
definitely
of Australians
confusing it
in
with
it, actually. Eric Benner, an Australian actor, is in that. We're sorry. We should stop nostalgizing about war movies.
Bad war movies. Good war movies is fine. Bad war movies, no.
I like Dunkirk. Full Metal Jacket's good too.
The crew's main objective on their attack was to destroy the ships and port facilities of Darwin Harbour. All of the aircraft were launched from their host ships by 8:45 a.m. This wave was led by Commando Mitsuo Fuchida, who also had commanded the first wave of attackers during the raid on Pearl Harbour. So there's a lot of similarities between that one and this one.
Yeah, Mitsuo Fuchida, I think.
Or Fuchida. Something like that. On their way to Darwin, some of the aircraft shot down by a US Navy PBY Catalina and strafed a USAAF C-47 Skytrain. I really hate the fact that they're all different names. Why can't they just be American plane? American plane, big American plane.
You wrote this, which means you've done this to yourself, because I would have just...
I have to separate what models they are so that you can actually keep track of what planes are doing what later in the story.
I would have, like, to simplify it, I would have just said like a US C-47 Skytrain as opposed to a United States Air Force.
Oof. From now on, it's going to be just the Catalina and the C-47. So yeah. That's what they are in long terms for our plane enthusiasts that listen to the episodes. And we know that you're here because you send us messages
and
when we stuff it up.
Military enthusiasts, you're going to get very angry at all of our mispronunciations.
Especially the American ones. They were on the ground near Melville Island. At 9:35 a.m., Father McGrath of the Sacred Heart Mission on Bathurst Island sent a message using a pedal radio to the Amalgamated Wireless Postal Radio Station at Darwin that a large number of aircraft were flying overhead and proceeding southward.
Yeah, the other side of that story too is he was inadvertently actually trying to... Well, he inadvertently got that message out, but he was trying to foot pedal his way to possibly radioing Jesus. That's what he was doing. Though that was...
Which Holly's the crickets button?
Yeah, where's the crickets button? Didn't it? Come in, Jesus. Da-na-na-na-na. Need help. Da-na-na. Horrible war.
We screwed.
Could use some miracles. They actually had to operate those by foot pedal.
Yeah, that was how they got the electricity going.
Yeah.
Father McGrath's message was then relayed to the Royal Australian Air Force operations at 9:37 a.m.
Now, here's a little Australian colloquialism for you. This is where things start to go tits up.
No general alarm for the apparent attack force was given until about 10 a.m., as the RAF officers were wrongly thought that the sighting was of 10 U.S. Air Force P-40s returning to Darwin. They were returning to this base because of reports of bad weather, which forced them to abort a flight to Java. So instead of seeing Japanese Air Force attacking, they're like, no, they're just the Americans coming back.
And that's why I honestly believe they never thought they'd be a target.
4 months later, they see a Japanese airplane flying around Sydney. Like, nah, it's just the Americans fucking around.
Yeah, we do it.
I blame the Americans.
There's, it's really peculiar to look at Darwin from, you know, I mean, we've got nearly 100 years of foresight now.
Hindsight.
You know, of hindsight. So again, you know, you got to be really careful when attributing blame and things like that to these sort of historical events, but it's really hard to ignore the correlation between assumptions made in Darwin, similar assumptions made 4 months later at Sydney Harbour.
Mm-hmm.
And those assumptions led to a lot of casualties.
Yep. As a result of this misunderstanding, the air raid sirens at Darwin were not sounded before the raid was on their door.
Those are those really cool sirens.
The ones that in Nightmare Before Christmas, they just like crank a cat's tail and it's...
The ones that I always associate with films and be like, there's a hurricane coming.
Yeah. It's almost the same sound, I think.
Yeah. Air raid sirens and hurricane sirens. Same siren.
Petty Officer Yoshikozu Nagahama was separated from his squadron while he was attacking the US Navy flying boat and arrived over the city alone ahead of the strike force, which was probably scary as shit.
Well, if you're that guy, I agree with you. I'm sure it was like, fuck, 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 fuck. That was a lot there. I know there are a few people who listen and count them.
The dude who's counting is just like, I'm running out of things to count right now.
Yeah, he puts boxes aside. And thank you for listening. We love you, man. But yeah, one of our listeners puts boxes aside sometimes to count all the swear words. So I'm sorry for the work I just put you through.
If it's just eggs, just pick up a carton and put it aside. It's about the right number.
But hey, you got a shout out. So, you know who you are. We love you.
The rest of the planes had circled around the city in order to attack from the south. Now, Petty Officer engaged 5 US Army P-40s and single-handedly shot down 4 of them. So I'm pretty sure that was an adrenaline rush rather than actual skill. The first of the Japanese raiders arrived over Darwin at 9:58 a.m. HMAS Gunbar was the first ship attacked, strafed by several fighters. The town's air raid sirens were belatedly sounded, failing to give the surrounding citizenry and martial forces time to get into position.
Which isn't great. Like, this is... So, in our previous episode, we talked about how many civilians were still left in Darwin.
2,000.
And the reason for that being is that you still need people to run the basic functions of the town in order to make it functional. So, for them, they're not having time to retreat to their bunkers, which is a problem. So, those people are there for a reason. You lose those people, the functionality of the town will fail. So, your base will therefore fail. So, this is a big problem. Not only that, the people who are actually trained to deal with what is about to occur are not being alerted to what is about to occur.
They're still in the shower. They're still on the loo. They're still like polishing the gun and they have still have to reassemble it and shit like that. That's my imagination of what happens at about 10 a.m. on a military base.
Let's assume that that's correct.
The Japanese bombers dive bombed and level bombed attacks on the ships in Darwin Harbour, with this attack lasting about 30 minutes. The first raid resulted in the sinking of 3 warships and 6 merchant vessels and damage to another 10 ships. Hong Kong ship, the MV Neptuna, exploded while docked at Darwin's main wharf, causing severe damage to the surrounding infrastructure. At least 21 labourers working on the wharf were killed when it was bombed, and 45 more died on the vessel.
You got to understand just how shocking this event is. You're there, you're on the docks, you're working, you're doing the job that you've been doing for months and months on end. No problems. Everyone's been reassuring you that everything will be fine. You're never going to see anything in this little harbour. You're going to be paid well, you're going to do your job, and then you're going to go home and see your family. Then all of a sudden, ships are exploding in front of you and your colleagues and your friends are dying next to you. It would have just been, I can't imagine the trauma that someone goes through when experiencing something like that. From the sheer surprise of the attack is probably what was more shocking than the attack itself.
Especially after you've been coached for months that yes, air raid sirens will sound for 10, 15 minutes before they arrive. You hear it go for maybe 30 seconds and then it explodes.
Yeah, it's like, you know, gentlemen and ladies, we're going to march around in this square and we're going to tell you exactly how everything is going to happen. You're going to hear an air raid siren. You're going to retreat to your bunker. Better men will pilot planes and save your asses. This is how it's going to go down. And then it doesn't go down that way at all. Like, they're completely caught by surprise.
No plan ever survives first engagement with the enemy.
Yeah, absolutely. And unless you're drilling people constantly so that their brains shut off and their bodies just take over, you know, they have that muscle memory. You know, you've got... I just feel like things were lax.
Yeah, yeah. Because they were complacent. Complacency breeds neglect.
Yep. You know, you may be real annoyed that your workplace does a fire drill every 2 months, but those things could actually save your life just because you understand the routine.
Mm-hmm. An aerial photograph of vessels burning in Darwin Harbour was taken by a Japanese airman during the first raid, and you can actually find it if you Google it. It's on the Australian War Memorial. All but one of the US Navy P-40s were shot down or destroyed on the ground at the Darwin Air Force Base. Japanese aircraft bombed and strafed the base and civil airfield, as well as the town's army barracks and oil storage, attempting to shorten the resistance that could be applied to their next attack. They were also seeking to shorten any ability to resupply the town, targeting coal ships, supply runners, and merchant vessels equally.
And this was a big problem too, because we were the Eastern Front, correct? Western Front, Eastern Front?
We didn't really have the Eastern Front. We were Pacific Theatre.
Pacific Theatre. Thank you. I was looking. I couldn't remember
East
the correct
East and West are European times.
So you're looking at the Pacific Theatre. There's a diesel shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And these, like, they're desperate for diesel to keep everything running, to keep the war machine running. And this is where it was.
The majority of British oil was coming from Borneo. Borneo has been lost to the Japanese. And in order to prevent the Japanese from taking the oil, they destroyed the pumps.
Yeah. Because the Japanese were like, these are our pumps now. We're pumping out a lot of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Yeah. The Japanese pilots left the Darwin area at around 10 a.m. On their way back to the carriers, their crews noted 2 Philippine-registered freighters lying just outside the port, the Florence D and Don Isadro. This information contributed to planning for the second raid that afternoon.
Now, my understanding is the second raid was not planned. It was opportunistic because they were like, this shit's undefended. We can actually resupply, go back and do this again. Yeah,
pretty much.
And that was the case, wasn't it?
We lost like half a dozen planes. Let's do that shit again.
Yeah, that's how it was always taught to me when I was in school, that the first attack was a distraction because there was they were planning a much bigger attack elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, we've actually done some pretty significant damage. There's a lot more here than we assumed it was. Let's go back, resupply, and we can do this again and inflict more supply damage.
Yeah, we've damaged so much of their defenses now, they won't be able to kill us all.
Yeah, it was actually quite a happy little accident for one of the Axis powers there.
Yes, it was. Japanese losses may have been as few as 5 aircraft and 3 crew members. However, another 34 Japanese aircraft managed to land safely with battle damage, putting them out of action for another round. Warrant Officer Katsuyoshi Tatsuru and First Petty Officer Takezo Uchikado.
I think you did pretty well. I'm sure
I've obviously watched way too much anime with you.
Any Japanese listeners right now are like, we hate you so much.
You said that so badly. But you everyone know. Else is like, yeah, that's fine.
We're trying.
They were killed when their Aichi dive bomber crashed near RAF Darwin Base. Petty Officer Jaime... See, now you've put me on the spot because you're saying, you're doing so well. Toyoshima, a.k.a.
Yeah, that's great. I think that sounded great.
Tadeo Miniami was taken prisoner after crash landing his Damage Zero on Melville Island. More than one plane was forced to ditch in the sea and the crew rescued by the aircraft carrier. Allied ground fire was relatively intense and may have claimed all but 2 of the lost Japanese aircraft. Only one of the US Air Force P-40 pilots remained airborne throughout the first attack under First Lieutenant Robert Ostreicher and was later credited by US and Japanese sources with 1 Aichi shot down and 1 damaged. Toyoshima's plane was theorized brought down by small arms fire from Sapper's Tom Lamb and Len O'Shea of the 19th Battalion. Historians believe Tatsuru and Ukaido's Aichi was brought down by ground fire, possibly from a major Australian Army camp at Winelli. One pilot even reported that the damage to his plane came from hitting a tree in Darwin.
A lot of trees. Actually, no, there's not a lot of trees. No, what the not. Hell did he hit?
Obviously, I think he was a little bit too excited and came down a little bit too low because there's not many trees around there to hit, especially when they're being cleared for fortifications.
Yeah, yeah. He must have really went out of his way to hit that tree.
Also, it's really sad when the trees are doing about 10% of the damage to the enemy force.
It's a little embarrassing, yeah.
The second wave of planes, made up of 54 land-based medium bombers, arrived over Darwin just before midday. The town's air raid sirens actually sounded on time and went off at 11:58 a.m. when the bombers were sighted, offering more warning to survivors to either hide or grab their guns. The Japanese force separated into 2 groups. One formation attacked the RAF base Darwin from the southwest, while the other approached from the northeast, so basically pincer moving it over. The 2 formations arrived over the base at the same time and dropped their bombs simultaneously. The Japanese bombers then turned and made a second attack on the base. Due to defective fuses, the Australian heavy anti-aircraft flak gunners were unable to shoot down or damage any of the high-flying Japanese aircraft, which were estimated at 18,000 feet.
Check your equipment. Check your equipment. Make sure it's serviced. Check your equipment.
Especially when it's your only line of defense.
The amount of times I have been on job sites where they're like, oh, half the stuff isn't working. Did you check it? Have you been tagging it? Has it been maintained? Oh, no. And that's why we're all standing around waiting for this to happen. I hate poor maintenance. Drives me nuts.
Well, you have a little bit of a personal problem with that, but that's a different issue for a different day, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. What Holly's alluding to is the top of my thumb was crunched off in some machinery because they didn't replace a 50-cent spring in a gate.
Yes, that's why Matthew hates poor maintenance.
So maintain your shit.
The bombers left the Darwin area at about 12:20 p.m. Now, this raid inflicted extensive damage on the RAF base, though casualties were light thanks to the siren actually being sounded this time. Of the RAF airbase at the time, 6 Hudson light bombers were destroyed and another Hudson and a Wirraway were badly damaged. 2 American P-40s and a B-24 Liberator bomber were also destroyed. Only 6 RAF personnel were killed, which I think is an absolute miracle. The final tally of the dead was estimated to be 250 people, including civilians, though various estimates have pushed that number as high as 1,100. And we have a quote here from the Evening Advocate.
Australia has now experienced its first contact of war within Australia, the Prime Minister added. As the head of government, I know of nothing I might say other than these words. Total mobilisation is the government's policy. Until such time as it can be put into effect, all Australians must answer the government's demand for everything they can do and give.
Those were the opening words, I think it was Mr. Curtis at that point in time. The Japanese carrier force launched a small number of D-3A dive bombers during the afternoon of 19th February in order to attack the Florence D and Don Isidro, 2 Filipino ships that were on their way to Darwin. Don Isidro was the first of these 2 ships to be attacked and was rapidly sunk 40 kilometres north of Melville Island. 11 of her 84-strong crew were killed. The dive bombers also attacked Florence D and sank her off Bathurst Island with the loss of 4 crewmen. Among the survivors of Florence D were the rescued crew of a US Navy PBY piloted by then-Lieutenant Thomas H. Mora, who later became the chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Oh, that's a bit of a promotion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not bad.
Well, that's what happens when you manage to survive a world war.
And it's kind of sad too, like those, the people who were in government at the time during World War II, they were very alarmed at the like military industrial complex. And who was the president that saw them out? It was Eisenhower?
Eisenhower saw him out, yeah.
Yeah. He has a fantastic speech where he talks about the being worried about the military industrial complex, and it's on YouTube. You can go check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were some of the last, they were the last in government to really sound the alarm of like, we can't run our economy on building war machines and running forever wars. And then we just had a 20-year war in Afghanistan. So,
It's like Washington said, don't split into parties because you'll just keep dividing the country. And then what did the Americans do? Americans, people don't listen to the people who know better. That's just human nature.
There was a reason they called the World War II generation the greatest generation.
No, the greatest generation was their parents.
Was it?
Yeah, the greatest generation was World War I.
I suppose Eisenhower would have fallen into the greatest generation.
I don't know how old he was.
He was quite old when he finished. Anyway, that's American politics and American like history. It's
way out of my viewpoint. Yeah.
Even me, like I'm reaching for like parts. But go listen to that speech. It's really interesting. That's a hell of a promotion in the end. He ended up going quite high.
Once again, it is a point of those who fight the wars are very rarely the ones who start them.
Wasn't it Kennedy as well? He was a serving Navy man during World War II, actually rescued some people.
So was Elvis. Elvis was serving in the army during World War II.
I feel that Elvis was more of a propaganda tool, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, he was actually serving. It's not really a propaganda tool when most of your male population end up in the armed forces.
Really, really safe.
No, because he wasn't famous then. He wasn't famous till the 50s. He was famous
at that point.
He wasn't famous till the 50s.
Okay, like I'm willing to concede to you because I don't know much about Elvis.
I know just enough.
I know he married a 13-year-old.
And that's some of the bit that I wish I didn't know. As a result of the raids, most of the cargo shipping available to support efforts in Java and the Philippines was destroyed. The raids caused chaos in Darwin, with most essential services, including water and electricity, badly damaged or destroyed by the bombing. Fears of an imminent invasion spread, not just in Darwin, but throughout Australia.
The possibility that yesterday's raid led by Japanese fighters on Darwin was designed to test out the ground defences as a prelude to an invasion attempt. is regarded seriously by the Commonwealth government. Attempts might possibly soon be made by the enemy to land at more than one point in the far north.
And that's from The Herald. Some of the town's civilian population fled inland, no longer seeing any point in retaining their essential worker title, only to die in a battle on their home shore.
Well, that just sent a chill up my spine.
That's why I phrased it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Essential workers, remember? Remember, remember.
It's the an empty title. Workers. It always has been and always will be.
I feel like it is, yeah. Next person calls anyone an essential worker and they're not giving you a paycheck
or pay rise
or just giving you money, just punch them in the face. Actually, probably don't do that. Satire.
According to official figures, 278 personnel belonging to the RAF Northwestern Area Command deserted as a result of the raids, though it has been argued that the desertions were mostly the result of ambiguous orders given to RAF ground staff after the attacks. The commander of RAF Darwin, Wing Commander Stuart Griffith, gave a verbal order that all airmen were to move half a mile down the main road and then half a mile inland. At this vague rendezvous point, arrangements would be made to feed them.
Why? I don't understand why he wanted them to go over that way.
He wanted them to go over that way because that way wasn't burning and they could work out how many people had been killed, what they had left and what resources they could still use. They were just trying to gather everyone back into one spot so they could start sorting shit out.
Wouldn't it be worth their time, though, to organise the people in front of them and maybe put the fires out and rescue the wounded?
The essential workers are doing that. Why would they have to worry?
Yeah, it just seems odd. It almost seems as if it's a reactionary action.
If you're worried about a third group coming through to blast you again, you want your fighting forces out of the way.
Do you really want to gather them all up in one big spot so they can be taken out with one big bomb?
You do, but you don't want them in the place that's already been attacked because that will be an open area ground. You want to move them out of the way, especially if it's tree ground and cover and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you can get them under some trees for sure, but again, Darwin.
You're asking me. This is like... Well, 80 years ago.
I'm just speculating. It's just curious. It almost feels to me like just a... I got to do something. Let's do this.
You still have to evacuate people who can be evacuated away from areas that have been bombed.
Yeah.
That's just a reality because you don't want them like gas mains exploding and taking out half your armed forces.
I mean, look, you raise valid points. I'm not going to say you don't. It's just, yeah, I just find it curious.
The order led to utter chaos in camp. A game of telephone was initiated as the order was passed around. If you're in my generation, probably know it better as Chinese whispers. In its ultimate form, the order was interpreted as an order for immediate and general evacuation of the area. Highly exaggerated rumors of an impending Japanese invasion had already reached the base from the town and spread quickly among those wanting to believe them.
The British are coming. The Japanese are coming.
The funny thing is the British are coming would be false because the Americans were British at the time, so it would be more likely to say the Redcoats are coming. Just a historical anachronism that I want to fix. Yes. Don't give me that look.
She's not talking to you. She's talking to me.
I'm sure there's someone who's going, what the fuck does that have to do with anything? Some men simply gathered their belongings and abandoned their stations. The order was quickly rescinded, but by then, hundreds of men were beyond the point where recalling them would be easy. The Australian Army also faced difficulty controlling some of its own troops from looting private property due to the breakdown of law and order after the bombing and the ensuing chaos. Anyone who's listened to our episode on the Liverpool riots should have seen that coming, considering every time they walked past a pub that time, they broke in and stole the beer.
Yeah, you won't hear about this. And the reason that you won't hear about things like this is because...
Dig a legend.
So... The problem is when it comes to military history, there's first-hand accounts, the probable truth, what we can absolutely confirm, and propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the propaganda aspect is at the time, propaganda is, of course, used in recruitment. Then what happens is the legend becomes propaganda for current recruitment.
The legend builds out of propaganda rather than out of the truth.
Yeah. And so like what sounds better? That the men of Darwin got their guns, fought hard, sacrificed their lives, or fuck, some got really scared, packed up their shit, stole a bunch of shit from private businesses and got the hell out of there. That's always going to be an issue when discussing military history. And the other problem is that people react really badly to that. You know, the suggestion, and we haven't experienced any backlash, which is great. You know, we talked about, you know, the incompetency of people who were in command during Sydney Harbour. We talked about the Liverpool riots, which were disgruntled soldiers. And, you know, we're now talking about this. And I'm sure we won't get any backlash as well, because people hold the legend of the Australian digger, you know, very close to their hearts. And I do too. I come from a family that served.
We both have military stock.
Yeah, yeah. We're not shitting on soldiers whatsoever. My stepfather was a soldier. My great uncles served in World War II. My great great grandfather was a British officer during World War I. We both have, you know, military family. So we understand that, you know, you hold that quite sacred, especially to a lot of Australians. They hold that quite sacred. But humans are humans, and people are going to make mistakes, and people are going to act irrationally during high pressure situations. We have seen that over the last 2 years as we've gone in and out of lockdowns, as COVID has come and gone like an ocean with terrible crashing waves.
Looking at you, Sydney and Melbourne.
You know, so yeah, it's like, please don't have that emotional gut reaction to hearing things like that. And I say that because it's also important to remember that soldiers are human, which in my opinion makes their sacrifice that much greater, because they weren't superheroes. They were regular people.
There's a reason I didn't join the army.
Yeah. Look, I don't...
That's what it comes down to.
I don't know if I would be able to join the army should the situation arise, because I don't like killing. I don't even like hunting. I don't like fishing. Just because I don't like to see living things die. It's just not in my nature.
Unless it's a fly.
Yeah. Flies and Australians, we
it's have a war. Yeah, it's a war. It's the war we don't talk about. To make things more confusing, many civilian refugees never actually returned to their homes or only returned after the war was over. If they did return, some found the land they owned in Darwin was taken by government bodies in their absence. I have a quote here from the legislation that allowed it.
And third, subject to this act, the land in the territory described in the schedule to this act, beneath land compromised in the town of Darwin and its environs, may be acquired, whether by agreement or by compulsory process, in accordance with the provisions of the Act, for either or both of the following purposes, which shall be deemed to be public purposes of the territory, namely, A, the replanning and development of the town of Darwin and its environs, and B, the institution of a system of leasehold tenure from the Crown in respect to any such land. Now, if you think current lockdowns are draconian, imagine the government being like, yeah, it was pretty fucked up in Darwin, so we're going to take your shit to rebuild it.
Basically, we're leveling the entire place. We're going to take your house because we're going to build a new house on top of it, and you're not getting that house because that's our house now.
It's pretty brutal, actually. I'm surprised that no one's ever discussed it before.
There's a lot of things we don't discuss about our government.
Or our history.
That's why we have the show. But we do it on Weird
Crap in Australia. Don't you think it's weird that the government took people's houses that were blown up by the Japanese?
Or even the ones that weren't.
You know, that's why we call it Weird Crap in Australia.
That's why we're always waiting for the cops to show up on our door.
You know too much.
Okay. You're telling everyone else too much.
I just, like an ASIO officer bangs on the door. We come out and it's like, we've already got our bags packed. It's like, we're ready to go. We know what we did.
I can just imagine us both standing there in a bathrobes with like carpet bags, just holding.
Yeah. Yeah. We're sorry. We know what we did. Off to those secret cells that no one talks about.
Oh, wait. We shouldn't have said that either.
They listen every week. They have to.
Hi, our ASIO agent.
Yeah. If we're not being listened to by CIA, ASIO.
The Chinese.
MI6.
The Russians.
Well, I want to know why.
The Russian Federation and China are always on our listener list. So somebody in the government, if those countries, is definitely listening to us.
Yeah, absolutely. We know we're in trouble with you. We don't care.
We're not leaving Australia because we know, at least we know the demons that are here.
We're too small and we talk about ghosts most of the time. Like, don't worry about it. Enjoy the show. Just give us a good review on iTunes. That's all we ask.
The bombing of Darwin resulted in the destruction of some of the 11 above-ground storage tanks located in Stokes Hill. This led to the construction of underground oil storage tunnels in Darwin in 1943, which would hopefully safeguard these supplies from any further attacks.
Yeah, we might actually do, I don't know if we could do a whole episode on them, but we might actually cover them for a mini-sode on the Patreon side of things. Yeah, those big oil barrels have had a very interesting history.
I know nothing about them.
Yeah, no, it's worth having a look into, yeah.
While the bombing of Darwin in 1942 was considerable, it was not the last. More than 50 raids continued to raid down on the Top End, specifically parts of the Northern Territory and West Australia, between March 1942 and November 1943. One of the heaviest attacks took place on 16th of June 1942, when a Japanese force set fire to the oil fuel tanks around the harbour and inflicted severe damage to the vacant banks, stores and railway yards that remained there. The Allied navies largely abandoned the naval base at Darwin after the initial February 19 attack, dispersing most of their forces to Brisbane, Fremantle and smaller seaports. Conversely, Allied air commanders launched a build-up in the Darwin area, building more airfields and deploying many squadrons. As the Air Force concentrated their power in Darwin, the ships left harbour. In a pretty normal case of Australians thinking she'll be right, we didn't really do much about national security outside of the Darwin port until it was proved that Japan wasn't done with us yet. The Japanese Navy submarine attack on Sydney Harbour took place only 4 months later in May 1942. And then right after that came the second bombing of Darwin.
Yeah. So you can check that out, episode 68 for the Sydney Harbour attack. Was that episode 68? Yep. That feels so much more recent.
Sometimes I go back and I put in the number of the episode that covered. I'm like, wow, yeah. That was 2 years ago.
Yeah. You can actually track most of our marriage through the podcast.
The majority of it, actually. Because we're on year five.
Yeah.
And it's year four of the podcast.
Yeah, so we must have started this just a little bit after we were married.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. About 6 months.
That's cool just for us.
I'd like to point out the attacks on Darwin and Sydney were both designed as keep them occupied attacks, not true attempts to take the country, used only to distract the Allies from the Japanese Empire's true targets. What's the saying? Fool me once. The Akagi, Kaga, Hiryu and Soryu Japanese airliners, so aircraft carriers, were later sunk during the Battle of Midway in June 1942. So they actually went out in a blaze of glory.
Which is probably what they wanted.
Pearl Harbor, yeah. Bombing of Darwin, Battle of Midway, three major offensives in the World War II.
Yeah. They, all times you got to respect your enemy. That's how you defeat your enemy, by respecting their tactics. And these guys made it through.
Yep.
Nearly to the end. Because I think Battle of Midway was like the turning point, wasn't it?
I think that's the point where they started forcing the Japanese back, but I can't confirm it for sure because I don't know as much about World War II history as some people I know.
Yeah, because there's a lot of controversy as historians continue to debate whether dropping the nuclear bombs was the correct thing to do.
Whether it was necessary.
Because they do cite Japanese forces being unable to continue and retreating back to the mainland. Mm-hmm. Something for historians to argue about, definitely not saying I am willing to talk about. Yeah. But and it is linked to this, we will actually talk about American atom bomb testing in Australia.
Eventually, yes, when I get back around to World War II history.
Yeah. We it's something that we will keep returning to.
I try and give everyone a big mix of stuff every week, so World War II history might take another month or so to get back to. Well, actually longer than that, considering how long the episodes are spaced out. The bombing played a big part in the World War II psyche of Australia, but it hasn't really been deconstructed in popular culture the same way events like Kokoda Track and Tobruk have. While the event has been represented in books and novels, for example, The Diary of Tom Taylor by Alan Tucker.
Okay, I want to point out something here, a little weird synchronicity.
Tom Taylor is a comic book.
Tom Taylor is a Melbourne-born, and I think currently lives in Melbourne, Australian comic book writer who has written pretty much every single mainstream character you could think of at the moment. He's currently the author on Nightwing. He's writing a mini-series for Marvel called Dark Ages, a mini-series for DC called The Dark Knights of Steel. What else? He's crazy, the amount of stuff he's written. The Injustice books were all of his. Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? I wonder if he knows that. Someone should tweet that to him. Maybe I should tweet that to him.
I'll leave that for you to decide.
He's really nice too. We've met him a couple of times.
While the event has been represented in books and novels, it's rarely touched on in Australian pop culture. A fictionalised version of the Darwin bombing was featured in the second half of the Baz Luhrmann film Australia, which
and
made
it sucks.
It made it feel like two completely different movies just smooshed together, by the way.
It sucks. It's so bad. I hate Baz Luhrmann films. Oh, that upset some people. I felt it. I felt it as I recorded
the world
that.
Just twitched.
There was a disturbance in the force. A million voices cried out, "You fuck you, Matthew."
And there was also a TV movie adaption of Peter Gross's book, An Awkward Truth, made in 2012. Much like the Liverpool riots, the bombing of Darwin's climax of looting, desertion and such mars the event's history, making it one few people want to remember.
Or remember accurately. One of the things as well that historians have continued to argue about when it comes to Darwin is its actual death toll.
Yep.
Everyone has a different number as to how many. Like, there are some people that will go to the extremes of 1,100 people. Then there are other people who sit on 250. Eventually, the government was like 280. And it fluctuates between everyone. No one can actually agree on a death toll. Was that, and could that have been due to propaganda at the time? Who knows?
One of the problems is that they used the amount of wounded in order to calculate the amount of dead, because generally you have a 10 to 1 or a 5 to 1 ratio of wounded to dead. That's what they used rather than going, hey, I haven't seen Tim. All right, we'll put him on the casualty list.
Yep.
So
yeah, that one in itself is complicated. You want to ever, if you're ever bored, get two war historians together who cover the same subject.
And just say three words.
Keep buying them beers. Just watch. It'll be fun.
You'll learn a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not all of it will be accurate.
Well, that concludes our two-parter on the Battle of Darwin. We hope you've enjoyed it. The Battle of Darwin marks a first for us because this topic was actually selected by our Patreon supporters. If you would like a say in what we produce next month, because we're going to do one poll a month, I think.
Yep.
Yep. That's and
except for December, because we're taking December off. So there won't be a poll in December, but it'll be back in January.
We give you access to that poll at only $1 a month, which is pretty cool.
Any subbers.
Any subscription, you get access to the poll and you get to have your say in at least one episode we do a month, or it can turn into a series, which is what happened with Darwin. So bottom of my heart, thank you very much to our Patreon supporters who did select this episode. I enjoyed doing it. I think Holly enjoyed it as well. You like going back to World War II history.
I like history.
Yeah.
I think everyone who's listened to this show knows that I like history.
So big thanks to you guys. And if you'd like to get in on that, that's only $1 a month if you'd like to participate in the polls. If you'd like a little bit more weird crap in Australia in your life, you can upgrade that pledge to $5 USD a month. That gets you the mainline episodes completely ad-free, a mini-sode once a week, and a audiobook chapter as I record the audiobook for Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 1. So you get all of those for only $5 USD a month. So if you do have a few dollars to spare and you want to give us a hand with being able to purchase equipment and research material and digital storage, that's the best way to do it. Just type in weirdcrapinaustralia.com and it will take you straight to our Patreon page. Now, if you'd like to grab yourself a t-shirt or a Christmas present, do it yesterday.
Especially because this is airing on November 15th. So
Definitely
should have done it yesterday.
I reckon this is going to be pretty tight. But you know what? Give it a try. Maybe the Australian Post system has recovered somewhat. Weird Crap in it, Oz, AUS, Weird Crap in Oz, AUS.redbubble.com. That takes you to our profile there. You can check out all of Ignacio's amazing designs he's done for Weird Crap in Australia over the years. And you can get those slapped on a t-shirt or coasters or a mug. You can get all of our stuff on all of the stuff that you need in your home.
Yay.
Yay. There you go. Holly's very enthusiastic. If you do grab yourself a t-shirt, if you grab yourself a coaster, if we end up in your beer room, shoot us an email with that picture.
It's going straight to the pool room.
Straight to the pool room. Shoot us an email with a picture and we'll feature it on our social medias as a bit of a thank you.
We will be doing that movie at some point in time because it's an iconic Australian movie. Yeah.
Controversial opinion. I don't care for it that much, but I do believe it's a classic piece of Australiana cinema. It's so
the vibe of the thing.
We do have to take a crack at the castle. I'll be writing that episode too because you can't write pop culture episodes. Also, you can support us by grabbing our books. Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 1 and 2 are now out. Volume 1 has been updated. It's now in the second edition. You can grab both of those books in a digital format through Amazon.com or the Kindle app. And you can grab it in a physical. I like physicals. I like being able to hold something.
New book smell.
I love new book smell. I love old book smell. I love old books and how they smell. You can grab a physical copy of our book from lulu.com. Select those. They're a print on demand service and they will get that book out to you. You can also pick up physical editions from our friends at Impact Comics. You can head to their website, impactcomics.com.au, place yourself an online order. They ship all around Australia and they do click and collect at the moment. And I'm pretty sure when this goes out, they'll actually be able to have customers in their stores. So head down and have a chat with our great mates, Mel and Cam at Impact Comics and pick yourself up a copy of Weird Crap in Australia Volume 1 and 2. Otherwise, do you have some war history that you'd like to share with us? Maybe you had a family member that was involved in the bombing of Darwin. Let us know. Keep the conversation going on our Facebook page. Just type in Weird Crap in Australia in the search bar. You can also find us under the same name on Instagram and you can find us hanging out on Twitter. Our handle is at Weird Crap in Oz. And if you have a suggestion for an episode, if you'd just like to reach out and have a chat, or maybe you have some corrections that we need to make in the near future, shoot us an email through to weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. And for the last couple of episodes, I have been asking for small businesses to reach out to us. We do want to work with some small local business in Australia. Maybe you have a great pop culture store or a board game store, or you invented an amazing craft beer that's doing really well. We want to hear from you guys and we want to try and partner with someone who is that small entrepreneur who can't afford, you know, big advertising and you maybe want to work with us as a sponsor. So please get in touch with us, weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. We want to help little guys because we're the little guy and they're the little guy, and together we can be the medium guys if we all work together. So please give us a shout. If you're a business that has been severely affected by COVID, please get in touch with us because we generally want to help a small Australian business make it. And sometimes all that's needed is a little plug or two from us. So please get in contact with us, weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. And that's all I got. That's all there is. That's all there is. That's all there is, my friend. So let's keep dancing. And of course, Holly's final words. Nearly forgot.
Two things. Everyone sticks around to hear you sing, I'm sure.
I'm sure they don't.
And I looked up the Battle of Midway. It was the point where the Japanese Air Force was decisively damaged. All their aircraft carriers were destroyed. So that's where their naval power just evaporated.
Oh, well, there you go.
That was the turning point.
Awesome.
Yay, America.
America. America.
All right, quitting now. Bye. Yeah. I don't need any more of your singing.
You don't?
No.
Because you said
especially
quitting.
Especially not America.
Which made me think, closing time. No more calls for alcohol. So finish
the song,
your
block,
Pokies.
I think
beer.
I just blocked the podcast instead.
Bye for now.
See
you
later, guys.
And Holly will see you all next time for more Weird Crap in Australia. Bye for now.
The Weird Crap in Australia podcast is hosted and produced by Holly and Matthew Soule. Our editor is Blake Kell. Weird Crap in Australia is a production of The Modern Meltdown.